Welcome to all of you all over the world watching this first and to some extent experimental European Institute School of Public Policy event. The event is entitled, What is Coronavirus Telling Us About the State in Europe? And I'm Tony Travers from the School of Public Policy. And what we're going to do is have a classic panel discussion with three speakers who I'll introduce in a moment. And once they've each spoken, we're having a bit of technical difficulty with one of the speakers, but we'll keep going. Once they've all spoken, we will then take the opportunity to have a bit of a conversation, as we would on the stage at the Sheikh Zayed or at the Old Theatre. And then there'll be an opportunity for you to contribute through the chat button. If you look at the bottom of your screen, you can contribute in that way. By all means, say who you are, where you are geographically, and then make a comment or ask a question of the panel. It would be good if you can keep your microphones and cameras off. That will allow us to get the maximum strength of signal, and so everybody can hear everybody, I think. And other than that, I hope we'll have a fun evening. Now, our three speakers are, in the order they will speak, Professor Kevin Featherstone. He's Professor of Contemporary Greek Studies and also Doyen of the European Institute at the LSE. Valtrold Schelkler, who is Assistant Professor in the European Institute and an expert on banking and finance and economy. And Juan Costa Font, who is an assistant professor in the school, the LSE's Department of Health Policy. So between...
You make us feel very useful.
We are going to be...
We are not assistant professors.
I'm so sorry, you'll be professors. Anyway, yeah. Forgive my bad start for me there anyway. So we are going to have a bit of a discussion, starting with... Kevin Featherstone, who's going to talk about the broader political issues that have been raised by this remarkable event. But just before I introduce Kevin, or let Kevin go, I just want to say a couple of things from the chair myself. I mean, clearly, the coronavirus pandemic is a major event affecting the whole world at once. Nothing quite like it's happened since there was last a world war. And of course, within Europe, there are different economic, political, and healthcare systems, all of which are now under pressure at the same time, in, again, a way that really hasn't happened. There's nothing like this for decades. I think it's fair to say there's been little coordinated action so far, rather less than one might have hoped, multilaterally, either within Europe or globally, though that may change. And to some degree, each country has been immediately doing domestic policy for themselves, which I think comes as a bit of a surprise to many of us. And of course, this event will have major economic, political, and other impacts for years, possibly decades to come, as countries attempt to protect their economy by massive amounts of borrowing in an attempt to flood resources to protect businesses. And by doing that, to ensure that as much of the economy survives through this to the other side. But the downside of that will be massive indebtedness and possibly the need for austerity or higher taxes or both in many countries for years to come. And one final thought, of course, the UK government is still committed to the transition period for leaving the EU to end on the 31st of December this year. That is still stated UK government policy with implications for the EU 27, for each country in the EU and for the UK, of course. Anyway, enough from me. So I'm going to ask Kevin Featherstone to start us off this evening. Kevin, over to you.
Thanks, Tony, and welcome to each of our students joining us from the European Institute and the School of Public Policy. As Tony's indicated, it's a major, potentially transformative crisis. And I think as social scientists, we can bring to bear different tools, different frames by which to understand the significance and potential outcomes of the crisis. So as a political scientist, I want essentially to focus on two questions. how the state behaves in a crisis and how the crisis may change our view of how the state behaves. Let me begin with how the state behaves in a crisis. And I want to refer here to a sense of different national governments responding in ways which are somehow culturally shaped by the various traditions. And I want to focus in particular on the notion of a state tradition at the national level, and then also administrative cultures affecting the instruments that they use. So by a state tradition, I'm referring to some literature, notably the writings of Kenneth Dyson, the state tradition in Europe, but also political theorists concerning the relationship between the citizen and state authority. More particularly, how we see ourselves in relation to state power, state authority, and what the position of the individual is in that regard. By administrative cultures, I guess I'm referring to instincts, norms, predispositions, things which seem to be habitual, instinctive, deep-rooted, such that the actions that a state administration takes appear to be, to the actors concerned, commonsensical, self-evidently rational. Why would you act in any other way? Now, I want to just highlight some contrast that we've witnessed at the beginning of the crisis. I've just come back from Italy, where I was staying for a few months. And I'm struck in the Italian case by, of course, sadly, Italy had a deep crisis with the virus at a very early stage. But I'm struck by the Italian case, the response being very much state-led. Civil society reacted to the state. Civil society caught up, as it were. And the actions the Italian government took were very much consistent with what we would assume from its administrative culture, very legalistic, very formalistic, etc. So we had presidential decrees issued at 9 o'clock in the evening to take immediate effect. There was very little warning for schools, colleges, shops, restaurants to be closed. I noticed that when walking around the streets outside both private and public buildings, you'd have official notices referring explicitly to presidential decree, blah, 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 etc. Very formalistic in that respect. And of course, the formality also stretched to the requirement that citizens who ventured out onto the street should first of all download a form from the internet and complete the form to justify why they were going out onto the street, seeking the explicit permission of the state in a state application form, as it were. So in that respect, the tradition of the Italian states, its tradition of administrative culture, seemed to be very much brought to bear. We think of the Italian tendency in terms of a Napoleonistic administrative culture. Now, of course, the sharpest contrast was with the Anglo-Saxon cases of the UK and the United States, Boris Johnson and Donald Trump. Here we had civil society seemingly acting faster and taking the initiative. Universities, not least the London School of Economics, colleges were taking the initiative. Theatres were being closed, churches were stopping their services. All of these things happened before the government made any legal requirement for behaviour to be adjusted. And it seemed that the instincts were the traditional laissez-faire, informal guidance. The state was being reactive, not proactive, at the beginning of the crisis. And many of us remember watching Boris Johnson on TV making his prime ministerial statement introducing the lockdown measures, it seemed almost palpable the discomforts of the prime minister in imposing these legalistic measures, very much against his libertarian instincts. I thought it was also interesting that in the case of the UK, the British government's referred to behavioural science and indeed the so-called nudge unit at number 10. The state was not imposing on citizens so much as wanting to manage pragmatically how people might behave. It was a question of looking at behaviour alongside the medical science. And of course, this also led to controversies over strategies based on the so-called herd instinct or herd strategy. If we take another case, Sweden, then I was very much struck by a news report which said the following. The Swedish government maintains that citizens can be trusted to exercise responsibility for the greater good and will stay home if they experience any symptoms. The Swedish government maintains that citizens can be trusted. Citizens can be trusted. I can't imagine an Italian or Greek administrative culture coming out with such an expression. But clearly there's a distinctive sense of social solidarity, the individual as part of a social whole. Again, what we know of Swedish civic culture would lead us to almost expect such a response. Now, these particular cases that I've highlighted are, of course, illustrative. When we think in terms of state tradition, type typologies, etc., typologies simplify, and the cases, I'm sure, are much more complex, and we could have counter cases in similar categories of state traditions, etc. But I think we're detecting something of difference, which is of interesting core centrality here, in terms of how states initially respond in a crisis and the kind of administrative instruments they think they should bring to bear. Each of them seem to be natural, instinctive, commonsensical, as it were. Now, if we think in terms of the nature of the crisis, Tony started by emphasizing the global nature, sadly it is, also a sense that it's a historical landmark. Out there in public debate is the suggestion that the crisis might produce a kind of pushback, a protest against globalization. The crisis has led to borders being closed, ethnic minorities being attacked, blame being shifted, repatriation, rescues of our citizens back to the homeland, etc. It all suggests the discourse which could potentially be anti-globalization in that respect. But I think we also have to counterbalance here the fact that it's evident that the pandemic is showing very strong feelings of empathy across borders. Our everyday conversation is much more international than normal. We refer in conversation to the rates of infection or fatality in Italy, in Spain, in the United States, etc. Our news is looking globally at this pandemic. And of course, in this pandemic, we're also following what experts are telling us about the projections, what we might expect this weekend or later. And we appreciate that the pandemic, sadly, doesn't discriminate. We're all, in some sense, in this together. Now, those features that I've just mentioned don't seem to be the resources which would readily help a populist counterattack against globalization. Populists deal with other kinds of resources, not those. The crisis, in other words, I think is showing out mutuality. And it's far from clear that the legacy of the crisis will be one of anti-globalization. Let me finish with a final point about the potential medium to long-term legacy of the crisis in terms of how we think about the state, what the state should do, and what the state can do in respect of society and economics. Well, of course, initially, the response of the state has been spend, spend, spend. We've seen Boris Johnson announcing £35 billion worth of actions, subsequently additional expenditure announced by the British government. Donald Trump last week agreed with Congress a $2 trillion package of support for the US economy. And we read of Angela Merkel in the Ordo Liberal Citadel, as it were, announcing the biggest increase in public expenditure in the post-war period. So the initial response of spend, spend, spend has been very noticeable. And I have to highlight here the British case of Boris Johnson saying very carefully and explicitly that there is such a thing as society, very clearly going against the mantra of Mrs. Thatcher from the 1980s. Now, this was a totemic statement. He was speaking to his conservative audience. There is such a thing as society. We're breaking away from the 1980s legacy. We think of this crisis as being potentially the biggest thing since the Second World War, as Tony rightly indicated in the introduction. What do we think of as the legacy of the Second World War? We think of it as leading governments to take much greater responsibility for the levels of employment, for welfare, and for infrastructure. A sense that the state had to be enabling. And I think we may be living through something of a similar experience here. We're expecting the state to spend, to rescue, to support jobs, to encroach into areas in systems which would not previously have expected such governmental action. Our expectations of governments have changed. I think these expectations seep into the public psyche. It's part of our psychology, our collective imagination, as it were, of what we and our state should be doing. And I think these kind of effects, these expectations of the state, will not be easily shifted. I can't see that despite the spend, 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 we could easily, after the crisis, shift to a discourse of neoliberalism, austerity, and cutting back. In the UK, the praise for the NHS, in other countries, the coming out onto the balconies of Italy and applauding the health workers, etc. This is a public mood which is very much supportive of greater public service. This evening at 8 o'clock, many in the UK will again go out of their houses and applaud the NHS staff. I will be doing so because my wife is a doctor and I wouldn't wish to exercise any autonomy in not participating in this social event. But I think then when we think about the crisis as political scientists, we think of the state and what we expect it to do and what we think it can do. And I think the crisis is impacting on our thoughts in that regard. And in that respect, it may well be transformative. But I'm very much looking forward to the other contributions and hearing from our students, who indeed may be located in many different parts of the world and can contribute their experiences and their knowledge of these different cases. Thanks, Tony.
Kevin, thank you. Excellent, brilliant introduction. Altrud, bumped into the fact that this is one of the most important economic impact for Europe and individual countries in all our lifetimes. Tell us about how you think this is.
So I was asked to talk about Germany's response to the COVID-19 crisis at both the domestic and the euro area level, because obviously Germany is, for better or worse, a crucial state in the EU's response to this whole thing. And as a big economy in the world economy, it matters what Germany does. Let me start with the domestic response. And like for many in times of crisis, I think the sitting government, the incumbent government, at least at the first phase, always does rather well. And so does the Grand Coalition in Germany, has at the moment a real high in approval ratings. It went that route that South Korea had started, namely heavy testing. It does at the moment, it is said, about 500,000 tests a week. We know how much the government in this country, the UK, struggles with that. Germany was to some extent lucky. It simply had a big producer of such test kits in the country and could do it. Unfortunately, it also made it in the beginning impose an export ban on such on these test kits and other medical equipment that quickly was lifted, but it gave immediately the impression that Germany is first and foremost caring for itself. It had done what it had done in the last crisis very successfully. It revived this short-time work program by which a single worker can get 60% of their wage or 67% of the net wage if you are a parent. Almost one, and the rest of that wage is split, the loss of the wage is split between employers that pay 20% or, and a loss of 20% has to be carried by the single worker. Almost 1 million firms have already applied, among them the biggest car firms and all that. So it is a big deal, this program. But even more, the German government has promised to protect business with new measures to provide liquidity and has deliberately said there is no limit to how much the volume of these measures. It depends how long it takes. It has asked its development bank, KfW, that actually comes out of the Marshall program from the war, to lend as much as 610 billion euros to companies to cushion that effect of the euro, of the coronavirus crisis. This includes generous, like the short-time work scheme, to take in self-employed and freelance workers. So to all intents and purposes, this is quite generous. It has also done something which in Germany is always a big deal whenever rents go up. You know probably that Germany is actually one of the few countries that has not a high home ownership rate. So many people live in rented housing. And the law is actually quite favorable to renters and tenants. And what it has immediately said is, as of 1st of April, rent payments for people who have income shortfall or actually sickness due to the crisis, they can suspend rent payments for 3 months. They have to pay back later in the next 1.5 years, but in principle there should be no losses for landlords, but they must accept that the next 3 months they don't pay, and also that utility payments can be suspended for these 3 months. So there is also protection for households on top of all the unemployment, sickness benefits, and so on and so forth. So with full force, the welfare state, it doesn't always quite fit so nicely this ordo-liberal image that Germany has. It has come in with full force and heavy-handed underwriting of all the losses that are possibly made. What about the euro area and the EU response? I had already indicated one of the real black spots on its record already in the early days of the crisis was that it imposed an export ban on medical equipment, which is legal under single market rules, because basically in public health, you can do almost anything with a justification on public health issues. What about the fiscal response? I mean, as usual, the EU started out with a fiscal response where everybody in the council basically said what they do, perhaps with a little nudge that they should do something. And I have to say, I would actually defend it. Europe was at least 10 days ahead of the United States with its programs that were loosely coordinated, but everybody did what they can do given the circumstances, their own constraints. And as Kevin already indicated, one was kind of happy that Germany did more than it did last time, where Sarkozy really had to push Germany very hard to come out. And then they did actually in three installments quite a big stimulus program. It so happens, I read that in the New York Times today, the program added up to a bit more than the 2 trillion that Trump the other weekend signed off. So in a way, the stimulus program that came out of this loosely coordinated national measures ended up with the same sums. And on that, I would say on top, the EU welfare states have just bigger automatic stabilizers. So on the whole, I think for a first response where quickness and speed is part of an effective reaction, the EU hasn't done as badly as it always is told, because it is not the big bazooka. We can all do the math and add up, and you know, when you add up, it doesn't do so badly. As regards further measures, because obviously what we've learned is that virus is about as unfair as the financial markets, if not more so, by hitting two countries very hard that obviously have come out of the last crisis extremely vulnerable, Italy and Spain. And there was an open letter. Lorenzo Codono is in the audience, and he may later want to come in, because I read an extremely interesting piece he has published in an Italian newspaper. So they came out with this letter, 9 countries, leadership of France, we want a Corona bond. And what the other camp, so-called creditor countries, I would call them guarantor countries, guarantors of bailout funding, said is, no, we have an existing instrument for this. You can get a preemptive credit line from the EMS. But the EMS has, the way it has been handled, and Troika programs have come across, again, for better or worse, they have become so toxic that an Italian government at the moment cannot accept easily an ESM credit line with some conditionality. Now, there may be more to this than meets the eye, and that is where I would like to have Lorenzo come in, perhaps. It would help to use the OMT, the famous outright monetary transactions, do whatever it takes if necessary, that the ECB could then use, because this program is conditioned on an ESM program with some conditionality. If it's light conditionality, one could very quickly mobilize that instrument. And like Lorenzo, I think this is where the Italian and the Spanish government may have to move and swallow their pride and say, this is what we do. Perhaps they can then in return get something out of this in terms of a Corona bond that is perhaps time limited in the first instance, but something that has a common liability to it. How did Germany position itself in that discussion between Corona bond? I should say, I have a little duck. This is her, right? Angela Merkel is a lame duck, and she plays that role with gusto. She probably sides with the Netherlands, that has decided to become the hardliner and being very outspoken, to the point of where the finance minister of the Netherlands says, perhaps we should show a little bit more empathy. And between in France, because she doesn't want to weaken the position of Macron. So she will not come openly out against a French position. But it means, as usual, we don't quite know where she stands on this. She has made noises that a corona bond could be considered, so that's good. But whether she will deliver when it comes to it, that we don't know. So much from myself.
Walter, thank you very much indeed. What I want to do now is to call on Juan Costa Font, who I hope is with us. You are there, I hope, are you?
I am, yes.
Right.
Yes. So I have a bit of technical difficulty, so if I go out, just continue without me.
Okay.
I was planning to share some slides, see if I manage. It should be...
yes, we can see them.
I don't know whether you can see my slides.
We can.
Can you?
Yes.
You can? Okay, brilliant. So yeah, so I mean, just some slides just to organize some ideas. So I thought of just discussing a bit this corona COVID-19 crisis. So why is it so specific? So my argument there is that it's a global crisis. Health systems are not prepared to face this kind of crisis. They are not designed for this kind of crisis. They are designed primarily for crises that can be either are regional specific or they affect certain type of people, but not they don't affect all countries or all regions or all populations at the time. And then I will talk a little bit about why Europe is so specific. I mean, aging is a big issue in Europe. So this crisis is affecting particularly all age individuals. So Europe should have and hasn't had a unique response to this crisis based on its specific characteristics. And I would argue that one of the problems that we have in the public health arena, at least, is that there are huge limits of collective action. So most countries would pursue its own interests. I mean, Germany, France did that, limiting the trade of masks. Czech Republic did as well. Many other countries closed their borders. So there are limits to collective action, and this has been shown in the heterogeneous responses that countries have put forward to this crisis. And I would argue that there are legal grounds for the stronger EU involvement. There is a recent regulation in 2008, an agreement of the European Council that argues that, or that says that in the events that there are cross-border crises, then countries should allow the EU to step in. And that hasn't happened in this particular case. So I would argue that Europe has fallen short in this case. I'm not sure whether I see all the screens frozen, so I'm not sure whether I'm being followed. But I'll continue talking.
I can hear you. It's fine.
It's fine. Yes. Right. So yeah. So I might not be able to move the screen. So the slides. So I will basically talk as if there were no slides. So basically, my argument here is that because of the nature of the crisis, Europe needs to step in and develop what I would argue is a European public health authority, which would compare to the kind of authority that we see in federal states, like in the US, where that would be like an organization linked to the European Commission, and member states would have to follow its rulings. Now, as I was saying, I mean, this crisis is quite unique because it is affecting Europe in a very specific way. And other parts of the world, developing countries or low-income countries, they go through this crisis more regularly, whilst we don't face this kind of crisis in Europe. And on top of that, it's probably the first time that Europe gets some signal that actually globalization has some risk, entails some important risk, in addition to populism, et cetera, et cetera. There are actually real risks. And Europe is particularly more exposed to this risk because it's got like an aging population. I mean, the share of individuals that that are likely to face the consequences of this COVID-19 pandemic are much more severe in Europe. And the only advantage perhaps would be that because we have universal access to healthcare, then we can provide much more of a unified solution to the needs that that this pandemic involves. Now, if one looks at the data out there, you will see that there's huge variation in the number of beds, for instance, available for patients that suffer from critical conditions. So you will basically, if you were to see my slides, you would see that Germany is probably the country that ranks the EU countries in terms of volume of critical care beds. Well, at the opposite end, we have Portugal. Germany, it's got like a volume of 29 beds per 100,000 inhabitants, whilst Portugal, it's got about 4. So there's huge variation, and it doesn't really correlate with GDP. So it seems to be that there are huge differences across countries, and that would require some form of extraction. So it seems that countries, they basically look after themselves, some too much, some too little. And because this kind of crisis don't respect borders, one would expect to see some kind of public health action at the European level, as I was saying before. I mean, the response that different countries have provided to this crisis doesn't really reflect its objective needs. It is mostly reflecting the traditions of the different elites, and a bit along the lines of what Kevin was mentioning before. Different elites has shown their true faces here, and it's true that it is important to mention that there's been some collaboration. So Baden-Württemberg, for instance, has provided some help to some help to the region of Alsace in France, and it's true that for instance some patients have been transferred from Lombardy to Cologne to be treated. So there's been some collaboration, but it's been more the exception than the norm. And in terms of responses, I mean, there are a few blogs that I've written that they're out there. One is in BoxEU today. Basically, I just summarize what's been going on. Essentially, what we see is that this crisis has been used as an excuse for different member states to carry out police interventions that they would not be able to carry out without the crisis. So Spain has centralized its health system, for instance, whilst, for instance, we see that Hungary has been using this crisis as an excuse to govern by decree, or Poland and Austria, they have closed its borders as a way, in a way, to protect themselves against something that actually it's not very much that the governments actually at the national level can do very little about. So I would argue that there is actually a reason, a legal grounds for EU involvement. I mean, the although it's true that health policy is part of social policy and it's a devolved responsibility, the Treaty of the European Community allows actually the EU to. Or actually commissions the EU, I would say, to a high level of public of health protection. And then the Maastricht Treaty as well refers to public health as an area that the EU should play some responsibility. There is a DG Health. And in 2013, there is this European Council decision that argues that the EU can act when there is a serious cross-border threat. And clearly the COVID-19 is a cross-border threat that demands an action beyond nation states, because it does exert externalities to other nation states. And I would argue that if one was to look at other parts of the world, like the US, what we are missing in Europe is a public health agency, a sort of public health authority. In Europe, in the US, we have the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. In Europe, there is an agency that basically coordinates the information of different national public health agencies, but we don't have a CDC that depends directly on the Commission and takes action that is binding across the Union. And basically, this CDC agency that we have in Europe was very much the result of a crisis, was the result of the SARS crisis in 2005. And in a way, it basically illustrates that Europe needs a crisis in order to reform its institutions to be more adapted to, let's say, a global world. So in a way, it might well be that this crisis, a bit again along the lines of Kevin's ideas, it might actually mean a change, or it might bring a change of mentalities towards perhaps a stronger role in this particular case of not just the state, but actually I would say the Europe in areas of decision making that it has not been particularly strong in the past. And perhaps one of the arguments that could be made is that Europe is not just about having a EU passport, it's not just about a common market, it is about as well the European health card, about you know, protecting us against these global public bats that would call us to talk about a European health citizenship, perhaps. So that's what I thought of saying today. I'm happy to answer questions and engage with the debate.
Okay, Juan, thank you very much. And if you can remove your slide from the screen, feel free to. And what we'll try and do is, if anybody like your slides, including the ones that sadly we didn't see, we can arrange if anybody just emails they'd like to see them for them to be sent, if that's okay with you. So what I'd like to do now is, with the three speakers, and now I should say, anybody wants to send in comments, questions, thoughts, now's the time to do it. Say who you are if you wish to, where you are in the world, that'd be good, add a bit of colour to it. And if you've got experience, as Kevin said, that you'd like to share with us, then please feel free. That'd be, in fact, encourage, not just feel free. So just to start the questioning going, really, I mean, I think, Valtrud, you slightly pushed back from something I had, the idea that the... that this is a major international and for Europe multilateral event, and yet we've seen, and Joanne just referred to this, quite a lot of each country for themselves. And it seems to me when this is all over, there'll be a series of inquiries in each country. But I mean, overall, not just in fairness, the EU and European institutions, but global institutions haven't really been as present as each nation state for itself. And it's not a great argument, this is my view, question, not a great advert for multilateralism, what's happened so far. I don't know, any of you disagree with that or would want to pick the theme up?
I agree and I disagree with it. Let me start with a disagreement. I think in a situation that is so uncertain as the one now, I would also not have a big problem with that the responses were heterogeneous, as Joan put it. I have a problem with them that they're protectionist. Europe was quicker in its fiscal response because it was uncoordinated. It is a problem that when you have to coordinate in something that is unprecedented, where they're not the usual routines just come into place, that a lot of coordination will slow you down. And it is then sensible to do whatever you can and what you feel is right for your country. At the same time, I'm always for reinsurance by a collective arrangement, and that needed some time, it has now started, to help those who are extremely affected by it, because clearly Italy is overwhelmed now. And what has started at the bilateral level is that, for example, Germany, with, as Joan just told us, with its lot of intensive care capacities, has flown in some patients. I mean, it's in the double digits from different countries. But at least it has done this, and this should have happened earlier. So I see where the impression comes from, but I think, as usual with the EU, the impression is a bit worse than the practice. And therefore, I would also defend a diversity of responses if they come quickly. And I don't think we can learn much from the US in terms of that response. If you see what's happening in New York or something, I mean, even a federal system doesn't protect you. And then a very centralized mistake has massive consequences for all, while a more decentralized response simply cannot become so consequential for the whole polity.
Okay, very helpful. And I don't know, Kevin or Joanne, you want to comment on that issue before I move on to something else? Kevin, you're muted. No, you're still muted, I'm afraid. You were briefly unmuted.
Can you hear me now?
Good, very good, yeah.
Despite the delay, I wanted to agree with Valtrout's essential point, but just to add that whilst we have this narrative at the moment of every government for themselves, I think we also have to take account of public reactions. I think the public is much more international than that kind of conception gives credit for. I think we are showing an international empathy. I'd also add the point that Jan was making, I think, that the European Union has developed over crises. Crisis is a stimulus for action. And it would be crude, of course, to assume an immediate response. But I think the legacy may well be to provide a stimulus the like of which we didn't expect for a greater EU capacity in these kind of areas.
And Joanne, do you want to add anything to what Valtrout and Kevin have said? If not, what I'd like to do to three of you, or two of you if we've only got two as I know, is also to say, is, I mean, this is a comparative exercise looking at essentially how different states. We've heard about Germany's remarkable response, and Kevin, you mentioned Sweden, the UK, and so on. Now, at the end of all of this, we're going to have, and I mean, political, social scientists more generally, and I don't want to make this sound as if it's a good thing, it isn't a good thing, but we'll have a remarkable exercise to compare and contrast how different security arrangements work, how different healthcare systems work, how different banking and finance systems work. I mean, it is going to provide a most remarkable opportunity for study and comparative study that we've seen possibly ever. I mean, certainly in modern social science times. Is that right?
Is that for Joanne?
Well, either. Anybody who'd like to say to speak, really. Feel free. Valtrout, go on.
Yes, I think we have a huge chance to compare and contrast. I was a bit curious of whether it is all about state traditions and administrative cultures, if I may ask Kevin on this, because I feel even between those where you would think should be similar, say France and Germany then, well, no, they have different state traditions, you have a point there, but you know, in that sense, every state is different, and I was wondering where you have notice one thing that is actually a bit pattern that I have observed, but I would wonder whether you agree with me, is this. You have talked about the empathy across borders between citizens, which is something I also strongly feel, so to speak, in daily experience, but also simply the loss for right-wing anti-immigration parties. They do not benefit from this at the moment. So the fall of the AfD, but also Salvini cannot, in Italy, cannot benefit in any way from this. And at the same time, we see the first responses by the elites as if they think there is a nationalist will among its electorates and reacts in a way that I just illustrated with Germany, but when Joanne mentioned others. Where does that come from? Do you think elites are more unilateral in such instances, or because they have the wrong expectations from what their voters want and react opportunistically to that?
I think the initial response to a crisis is indeed one of holding on to what we know, and that is usually national. it's usually the ways of doing things that we're familiar with. It's path dependence in that respect. And I, of course, there's an expectation of governments doing something about it. And I think in that respect, they've been, I suspect, rather surprised by the extent of public empathy across borders. The world of 24/7 news showing us the heart-rending situation of hospitals in Italy and Spain, elsewhere, etc. So I think it's more that the national government instinct is somehow internal, path-dependent. And the surprise here is not how national governments have responded. I think the surprise is how the public has responded, aided, of course, by media and the and social media. And I think that is something which is difficult to, you know, to be fully sure about at this moment in terms of its legacy. But I think the responses, my point essentially was to say that the responses have been more culturally shaped than perhaps is often recognized. But added to that, it's a culturally shaped at the national government level in terms of institutional action. And it rather contrasts with how the public is responding. As Valtrad has said, this isn't a situation in which the public is looking to victimize. I noticed in the Greek media these last couple of days, the attention given to the first coronavirus fatality in a refugee camp, and the photographs gave a very striking image of course, the crowded nature of those camps and the vulnerabilities of those with them. So I think we have two contrasting pictures here.
Okay, before I bring in Joanne, I just want to say for anybody watching online, we've got a moving population of between 55 and 60 people online. If you don't want to put in a question via the chat function, you could use, I'm just reading what I'm being, I mean, I've got instructions here. You could message the host who can unmute you and their video, so you could actually join in personally, should you like to. But I'd really, really like to hear from many of my colleagues, or two of my colleagues mentioned actual named individuals who are part of this event. We want to make it a joint event, so do feel free to bring us comment or news from wherever you are, either by the chat function, or if you'd like to say it on video and be heard and seen, we can allow that too. But Juan, sorry, I interrupted you. I think you were about to say something.
Exactly. I'm very sorry because I have technical problems, so I'm going on and off. And but I might have missed some of the comments before. But let me just, I picked up some ideas that I thought might be interesting to comment. One is on the point on decentralization. I fully agree that certain parts or certain reactions to this public health crisis are better dealt on a decentralized basis. So, for instance, the UK would be an example where Scotland and Wales were front runners, and Boris was actually forced to go a bit more, let's say, ambitious when it came to public health measures than perhaps he would have wanted to. So in a way, Scotland and Wales took the lead, and the same applies to Italy. And Veneto took the lead, and in fact, it has shown much better results than other regions in Italy. Now that said, there are measures that require collective action at the EU level, such as interventions on the single market, and that cannot be done on a decentralized basis. That requires some authority at the top, and I guess that's what Europe has been missing. And then on the point that Valtrad made on what is guiding the elites, I think that elites are using any opportunity. They are opportunistic. I'm sorry to take such a sort of gloomy sort of perspective, but I think that any opportunity is good to take advantage of. And I guess that because elites think that way, we should, take the same approach. And, if the purpose of Europe is to sort of develop a further European integration, perhaps we should use this crisis to do so.
Okay, yeah. Great. Now, I think Lorenzo would like to join. Is that right? Those in this, it's like being in the studio, really. Can we add Lorenzo to this conversation?
Are you there? I don't know whether you can hear
me. I forced him on the panel, right?
Join us. Hello. You've got the floor.
I mean, Valtra actually brought me in, so I have to say a few words. And so thank you. Hello, everybody, by the way. And a few words on Italy. Well, first of all, I think there has been a little bit of a confusion in the first reaction, okay? And that was a bit complicated by the fact that in Italy, the healthcare response is a regional competence. So complicates a bit matters. Having said that, probably it's difficult at this stage to see whether there has been major mistakes. And it's not clear why it happened in Italy rather than elsewhere. So maybe bad luck or maybe something else. I don't know. As a matter of fact, as we stand right now, according to my back of the envelope estimates, GDP contraction could be in the order of 10-11% this year, which is massive. Given the modest public spending approved so far, 25 billion, I would expect additional packages to be introduced pretty soon, which would bring the overall ticket to something like 70 billion, which would still be below what we have seen in other countries, but it would probably bring the deficit substantially higher, meaning that the debt to GDP will probably exceed 160%. In this situation, you can easily imagine that there is a big issue, there's a big problem here, and Valtrad mentioned that there is politically, there is hostility about the use of the ESM, which is true because the opposition, the center-right opposition, see that as a kind of first step towards having the troika in the country or something like that. And also on the part of some part of the government also are a bit opposed to that. But at this stage, there is very little alternative. In other words, I'm very much in favor of Eurobonds and the centralized fiscal capacity. But given that you cannot have it overnight and it takes time, you have to revise treaties and regulations and so forth, the only thing that you can activate immediately to prevent a financial crisis, which would come on top of the economic crisis, is to activate a precautionary line by the ESM, which would in turn allow the ECB to intervene without limits. OMT. And that's the only way to prevent the financial crisis right now, in my view.
And okay, thank you. That's pretty is, very helpful. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yes. No, I'll stop here. Thank you.
Okay. Valtra, do you want to respond to that at all?
No, I mean, I completely agree with Lorenzo.
All right, very good. Now, I've got some questions. Lorenzo, thank you. And by all means, stay visible and on the line. I've got some questions coming in thick and fast here. And so, first, to Kevin, you mentioned greater sympathy for one's fellow citizens, even across borders. Do you think that this could foster a greater feeling of European identity, especially when you juxtapose this to the refugee crisis, where greater sympathy did emerge, but not necessarily European solidarity? That's from Guillaume Pans. Kevin.
Thank you. At this stage, of course, it's difficult to predict, but if I think of the experience of the refugee crisis in the Eastern Mediterranean, recall that at the very beginning, the domestic responses in Greece in particular were very accommodating, very sympathetic. Greece had a history of refugees fleeing crises in very substantial numbers. One of the Greek islands was being nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize because of their accommodation of these desperate people. Of course, Valtrad is right that at the moment the radical right parties are not center stage, but we're just at the first phase, sadly, of this crisis. I think a sense of European identity, yes, but European identity needs agency, it needs leadership, it needs something to be built on. And I think Joanne is right that this crisis is creating a critical juncture, an opportunity for a greater competence at the European level, and that is also buttressed by a sense of a greater European identity at the popular level, but it does need leadership in order to be able to bring it to fruition. And so I take the thrust of your question. I suspect we would both wish European identity to be strong and sustaining responses. But I think it's, at the moment, it's a little premature to see the longer term legacy. And in these things, it does require leadership. And perhaps on that, the jury is out.
Thanks, Kevin. Now, I want to bring in another speaker, another questioner, by voice and by image, if you'd like to. This is Angelo. Who are you on? You on the line now? Can you be put on the line? There, brilliant.
I don't know if you can see me.
We can hear and see you. Super.
From the London Heart community, I guess. So I would like to go back to actually what Joanne was mentioning, which is, I think, also the core of the matter is a collective action problem that we are facing. So in view of any exit recovery strategy, like it was formulated in the EU Council communique, don't you think that the answer can only be a global one? So G20, at least. Because otherwise we can just close borders and live by ourselves in our country. Otherwise, given also that we are in a way just at the same part of the same story, just a different, you know, timeline. And we are actually seeing already a second wave, like it happened already with the 1918 Spanish flu, that already some East Asian countries are already having the second wave of these. Don't you think that unless we solve the collective action problem at the most global level possible, we would never be able to stop this?
Okay, great. Thank you for that. Joanne, do you want to comment on that? We may not have Joanne on. So Valtred or Kevin, do you want any response to that, either of you? Kevin, you need to unmute.
Can you hear me now?
I can. We can.
Joanne is with us now. Joanne, have you heard the question by Angelo?
No, which one?
Should this not be coordinated at the G20 level rather than at the EU level?
That's much quicker than I'd have managed it. Yes. Well, thank you, Valtra.
Yes. Yes. So on this one, I would say G20 countries are very heterogeneous in terms of, let's say, their healthcare needs. I mean, the US, some countries don't have universal coverage. Healthcare universal coverage. They don't. Many. The U.S. is quite a much younger country than most of European countries. So I would say it is true that you could expect a global reaction to the crisis. But I would argue as well that given the specific needs of a European population, then a European specific reaction would probably be more efficient here. And just because now I still. I'm still around. Let me just say that just on the previous points made on decentralization and centralization, it is interesting to see as well that Italy, despite being a decentralized government, it wasn't tempted to centralize it and use this crisis to centralize government, while Spain actually did. So I think that this kind of crisis are opportunities for states to reconsider their institutional sort of setting, And of course, I mean, you could think of, let's say, enhancing, let's say, the WHO role beyond purely, you know, what it's doing these days. But clearly the world is very heterogeneous. Europe is heterogeneous, but the world is 20 or 30 times more heterogeneous than Europe is. Europe is quite homogeneous relative to other parts of the world. So I would expect, you know, a European-wide reaction based on that.
I mean, I think one of the intriguing things, and having taken part in another event, slightly different one recently, I think Valtred was also involved in this one, the scale of resources available to European countries in most cases to fight against this pandemic is far greater than many countries in the global south. And the issue of how they get money and anything like the scale that any one major country in Europe gets it, you know, is up to multilateral institutions, and they too don't have anything like the resource that we are by implication talking about here in Europe. However, now I want to, it's coming up to 7:15, we've still got 50 plus people online. If our panel, esteemed panel, would live with us for another few minutes, are you all right, three of you, to stay with us? Okay, so I've got a question here, which refers back to something Kevin said earlier on, which says, thanks for the talk. I'd like to come back to what you said, I think you is Kevin, about countries using the crisis to carry out undemocratic policy interventions, quite a lot of them actually, but those I think particularly such as Hungary or Poland, voting through changes to elections law at 4 a.m. Do you think there's a role for the EU to not to intervene just in the economic area, but also in support of liberal democratic values in reaction to the coronavirus crisis? Very important question. Kevin.
Yes, and clearly we're seeing actions at the EU level. We've just seen statements by the leaders of, I think, 12 or 13 parties in the European People's Party grouping, condemning the Hungarian action. We've seen statements from the European Commission, which are also concerning in terms of the actions in Hungary. I think Hungary is an exceptional case, but certainly I don't see how we can sustain a sense of European identity in the medium term and not take action on Hungary. How could we live with the undemocratic actions of Viktor Orban at the moment and somehow say that we're sharing the same values? So I think, yes, it is stimulating more European response, more European protest at the governmental level than we've seen before. So we have an exceptional event and an exceptional response. And I would have thought that it would indeed lead to a more focused European action and the legitimation of Europe doing something about changes at the domestic level, because of the sense that we can't call ourselves Europeans sharing values, whilst Hungary is this exception.
Okay, thanks, Kevin. I'm going to move on because I want to get as many questions in as possible. So forgive me, my other two panel members. So we've got Sheila Encisco from Peru, but staying in London. Given my home country's in lockdown. My question, compared to other systems like the Chinese autocracy and to less developed countries, to which extent has the European response been different, easier, belated? So this is really a kind of comparing the European response with what you can do in particularly autocratic China. Which of you would like to comment on that? Kevin, go on, you'll go.
Okay. when China took the actions of lockdown, as you say, we assumed that this was something that only an autocratic state could do. But who would have imagined the kind of lockdown activities that we've witnessed across Europe in these last weeks? The essential point is with consent and with some degree of accountability in terms of the actions being taken. So linking with the previous point, of course, Viktor Orban would put Chinese authoritarianism to shame with his recent actions. But he's part of a club that we, in which this would be regarded as unacceptable. So I think the European response is, within a democratic frame, going beyond boundaries that we had previously assumed. But it is with consent, and it is clearly with a sense of public expectations that the government should be doing something to counteract the crisis.
Which is like to throw one thing in that also relates then to Angelo's suggestion that this needs actually to be coordinated beyond the EU. What I've heard is, so which questions a bit the value of coordination at the level of the G20. If anything, I would say WHO and UN and perhaps World Bank and so on. And this comes back then to this question. Apparently it is in countries like India, or perhaps Peru in Lima and places like that, not necessarily the best reaction to say lock down people and say they just stayed at home. They live in such cramped conditions in slums that you make both the infection and the pandemic worse, but also people can just not sustain it in terms of their livelihood. There is no welfare state they could fall back on. So in a sense, the opportunities are much more limited. And as Kevin says, if you have a kind of welfare this dictatorship like in Italy, in China, you can do it. And it looks actually a bit similar to what we do in Europe. But that's not an opportunity for many African countries, India, and possibly even Peru. That is why every country needs to make these decisions for themselves, obviously with a lot of expert advice and so on. But whether the G20 is the forum, I'm not so sure.
Okay, thank you both. I'm going to move on to, you've got two more questions which I'd like to get into before we wrap up. So one is from Capuchin Conis, if I pronounced that correctly. What effects of the coronavirus crisis can we expect to see on EU's border control and irregular migration policies? Do you expect it to lead to more collective action? So, Valtro, Kevin? Valtrode, you're muted.
Just briefly on this, not only was Hungary and Poland, and I think a third state, recently rejected and said it was illegal what they did in terms of the asylum and refugee policy and this whole quota system. So, and really, this was illegal, and solidarity requires that you stick with the rules. So I don't think they will be able to do to opt out after there was an agreement anymore like they did. Whether the appetite for allowing illegal migration rises, I'm not so sure. But at the same time, everybody can see that the situation, both in Greece but also in Turkey, is unsustainable, and that one needs to come to something that will not look pretty, but the present one to externalize the whole matter for countries like countries like Turkey or Greece or Italy for that matter is just not acceptable. I mean, Aiko is also here in the audience, if he's still there. Perhaps he would like to come in.
Aiko, I would strongly encourage you. Would you like to join at this very second? If you're still there?
He was bored with us.
49% people are still with us. We're doing well. Stay with us. We'll be 5 or 6 more minutes and we'll stop. Kevin, do you want to add anything to this?
I agree with what Valtra has said. We're in a fluid situation. We might have said before the crisis that the momentum was towards a harder stance to refugees and migration. Keep them out, stop the patrol boats, don't give them a lifeboat to come across the Mediterranean, etc. The narrative was really rather tough. I think we're now into a more fluid situation in which there is a greater degree of internationalism and a mutuality in terms of looking after our neighbour, as it were, the plight of those who are incarcerated in refugee camps has been highlighted. So I think the change is that we have fluidity, whereas the day before yesterday we didn't.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. Now I'm going to move on to, I've got two more questions, then we'll finish, I think. Zach, as first year MPA, School of Public Policy student, my question is, Professor Featherston referred to higher expectations people are raising towards state intervention and the whole size of the state. State intervention acts to solve market failures by leveraging a comparative advantage of the state in information vis-a-vis the public. To what extent does broader private data access, private data access must be accorded to the state for effective intervention to happen without incurring totalitarian drifts, as warned by Harari in his recent article with reference to China? So we're back to another of these, you know, how far can the state legitimately access data, which clearly it needs to in this struggle?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good. Yeah. My point was the more, was the wider aspect that's after the crisis. I think the sense that government is responsible for the provision of welfare, the protection of employment, and the provision of public infrastructure will be, I think, much stronger. That could be one of the legacies, central legacies of the crisis, and indeed would allow us to see the crisis as being a key transformative period in the post-war world. Now, in terms of civil liberties, you're right that, of course, one of the wonders of modern technology is that the use of phone apps and the tracking of mobile phones can be used to gauge whether citizens are a threat or not a threat according to their health condition. And there's a question there about how much knowledge the state should have. I suspect that when it comes to a civil liberty debate, we will see responses which are broadly reflective of the predispositions that I've referred to before in terms of distinctions of state tradition. In the Anglo-Saxon world, we very much think of freedom from the state. Why should the state have this knowledge, this information about us and our identities? I think elsewhere there may be a different take on that in terms of seeing this in a more instrumental fashion of how do we tackle urgent social needs, in this case a health crisis, and the state may have to appropriate information about citizens in order to tackle the monitoring of individuals with the infection rate. So I suspect when it comes to questions of drawing the line of civil liberty between state and individual, we're likely to respond broadly according to type. Anglo-Saxon, Northern Europe, freedom from the state, get off my back, you shouldn't have this information. And other systems with the sense that the state has a right to protect citizens and therefore a right to information, at least on a temporary basis.
Great, thanks. Walfred, Joanne?
I wish I could agree with Kevin, but I mean, to me, it seems to be a bit shambolic what the government here does, and in the United States. They have no problems to send drones to over you to look at you, the CCTV cameras everywhere. But when it comes to tracking people that might be ill, and do that without recording personal data. This was the squaring that circle that was a big debate in Germany, and they have now found a way of tracking people that may be infected, but without recording the personal data, so making a difference to China, but at the same time doing in effect what China achieved with this. So I feel the Anglo-Saxon here is just synonymous with ineffective and not using the state apparatus in a productive and constructive way.
Is that another way of describing laissez-faire?
Yes. Right, and then we've got one final question. I want to finish about 7:30, which and we've still got plenty of people online here, which is brilliant. Thanks for staying with us. But this is a great question to end. They've all been great questions and comments, but this is seems to me gets to the very, very heart of the broader reaction, state by state, block by block, globally. This is from Anna Zeromi, I hope I've got that right. Do you think there's a clear trade-off and no third way between health casualties and economic recession? And that question, of course, lies at the back, at the, behind all interventions in every country. At the moment, countries are trying to protect life, in effect, saying there is no end to the amount of resource we are prepared to use and borrow to do that. But of course, that can't go on forever, can it? I mean, there is a bite point between the amount of money a state can, in any circumstances, spend on protecting lives and you know, the future of the economy in that country or in many countries. So any response to this question is a way to end, I think. Baltred, Joanne, if you're still with us, any of our other speakers, Kevin, please go for it.
Joanne wanted, I think.
Yes. Yeah, just quickly, I would say there is a huge literature in economics on the value of a statistical life. So we have actually the tools to answer those kind of questions. We know Kip Biscusi, which is one of the most eminent economists, had a post yesterday about it. And basically he was saying, you know, that the value of statistical life in the US is about $10 million. So he was saying, based on that, he estimated that actually the this pandemic would justify an investment of about $1 trillion. So, of course, there is a limit to how much the government.
Can I say just say the of course the scandal of such kind of statistical value of life estimates that you know insurance and so on must have, but at the same time it would mean an Indian's life is much worth much less than that of an American or a European, and that has nothing to do with that life. It has to do with the earnings capacity of an Indian and of a European or an American. So I feel this is not extremely helpful. To Anna's question, I think there is not a complete trade-off. And we also need, and this goes a bit to what I just said, one has to make decisions on the basis of each country. If this goes on for very long, then one needs to also ask, does this make people's lives shorter in the sense of because of the sheer mental health problems, the stress, suicide rates, I don't know, divorce rates, all the ramifications that something like a lockdown has. It's not only about an economic recession and to perhaps take risks with getting out of it. That will be a valuable discussion that we have, and it plays exactly to this a question that you have. Let me just say this. Somebody told me the other day that the British government actually had since 10 years plans for a pandemic. These plans were there, they were tested, they were discussed, the plan. And the basic message that they first had to say, people will die. You cannot prevent this completely. Now, this is something that they found more and more difficult to say given the international reaction. But de facto, that there is an incomplete trade-off. That is the reality for all governments and is also objectively their difficulty. And there is no right and best answer to it, which we also as voters should keep in mind.
And I think it's fair to say that it says all healthcare systems at all times in all countries, certainly where there are European-style healthcare systems, are making these kind of trades. It's just they're not normally made in public with this kind of debate about them. So it's a really interesting question. Thanks for that, Walter. Kevin.
I agree with your point now, Tony. It's about rationing the provision of a public good. I think the only thing I would assert is the sense that the line or the tide has changed, I think, in the sense that we've lived through years of austerity and cutbacks, a sense that we could only provide basic health services on the basis of correcting fiscal imbalances and reducing debt, etc. I think the public mood coming out of this crisis will be much more sensitive about the quality of public services being provided, and therefore rather more resistant to a discourse of the all type, saying that we must live within our means and we must balance budgets and we must have reduced borrowing rates, etc. I think it's at the discursive level that we're likely to see the legacy of the crisis, and a public sensitivity much greater in terms of a sense of welfareism rather than of finance and financial discipline.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. I'm going to stop now, not because we haven't still got plenty of people online, but we did say we'd finish at 7:15, and I'm sure people have suppers and, in some cases, breakfasts to go away to. As I said at the beginning, this was something of an experiment. My instincts are, and you'll disagree with me or not, I think it probably worked, but it's easier for us to say this who are taking part in it, for those of you who are joining, and we can now bring more people in, I can see. So if anybody watching tonight now has any suggestions for how we can do this better, what we did right, what wasn't so good, please contact us through Rosemary, Rosie, who's been, I'll say a bit more about her a moment in doing all of this. So thank you all for joining us. I think we've roamed over a really intriguing number of issues to do with the powers of the state in different countries and how they're handled, to do with the extent to which economies both in Europe but also in the global south are going to be able to fund the kind of programs and indeed the length of time for which all of this is sustainable. And lastly, as we got to it at the end, who will pay for all of this? There is, by implication, a significant, and the former governor of the Bank of England and LSE colleague Mervyn King made this point this morning. This is, amongst other things, quite a significant intergenerational shift, potentially, as well, as the future has to pay this. And I agree very much with Kevin that I think taxes are going to pay for this more than cuts in public spending this time, particularly in the UK, where I think it can only be done realistically that way. That means a bigger state, as has happened after events of this kind before, and that point was made earlier. So I think we've ranged over a remarkable amount of territory. If any of my colleagues would like to say anything else, Kevin Waltrow, just very short comment. No, okay, you're shaking your head. Joanne, I hope you're still there in some shape or form. So to complete, I'd just like to thank Kevin Waltrode and Joanne, my professorial colleagues, for brilliantly rising to this first attempt we've made to do this like this. I also, as if I were a radio presenter or TV presenter, like to thank Rosemary Hines, Rosie Hines, who's of course the person who is the producer for all of this. We have a kind of producer who's summarized all the questions. But particularly, I thank all of you, just dropping below 40 now, for joining in wherever you are in the world and whatever time of the day or night. We'll do more events, certainly after this short Easter break, possibly even before, I don't know yet, we haven't really decided. So thank you all very much for joining in, and we'll see you all again, either in this form or we hope back in the normal way, in as near as soon as is physically and responsibly possible. So look after yourselves, and on behalf of both the European Institute and the School of Public Policy, good night, good morning, whatever time of day, and look after yourselves. Thank you. Good night.
Thank you, Tony, very much indeed.